That's a performance of the opening movement of the concerto by Antonio Vivaldi that's known as The Goldfinch, with James Galway, as he was known then, he's now Sir James, performing with and conducting what was then known as the New Irish Chamber Orchestra. He's actually coming to the Krannert Center at, in Urbana Thursday night with the Irish Chamber Orchestra on essentially the 35th anniversary of his first tour of the United States, which was with that orchestra. He's also coming with his wife, Lady Jeannie Galway, and a conductor, Joanne Folletta. The concert starts Thursday night at 7:30, and it's my great pleasure to welcome to Live and Local today Sir James Galway himself. Thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Nice to be with you.
So, Irish Chamber Orchestra, you've had a long history with them, what, 35 years now touring the United States? That's been a long time. What? Tell me a little bit about your relationship with that particular group.
Well, when they first started, it was conducted by a guy called André Prieur, who was a flute player and the premier prix of the Paris Conservatoire. And he really enjoyed my playing, and he asked me to make a few records with him. And I eventually did. Some of them I made without André conducting.
And in this case, you were conducting this particular recording.
Yes.
Was that towards the beginning of your own career as a sometime conductor?
Yes, it was, and I'm still a sometime conductor.
What's the appeal about conducting for you?
Well, you know, when you hear somebody play something, and you think, you know, this person who's directing this thing is actually just beating time. They're not shaping the chords in the orchestra, balancing a chord in the wind, or bringing out a certain viola passage which really should be heard. They just conduct it, and they wonder, was that okay? And I'm thinking, well, it wasn't okay because you missed this and you missed that and did this and that. You know, and all these things that I learned on the way up from people like Herbert von Karajan, Lauren Mazel, Leonard Slatkin, Zubin Mehta, and all these characters who stood in front of me and conducted. I didn't just play the piece, I listened to what they had to say and saw how they did it.
Have you found, as you have conducted, that some things were harder than they looked?
Oh, everything is harder than it looks conducting. I can tell you that right off. I mean, everybody thinks, oh, conducting's dead easy. Well, it is if you do it on a sort of low level, like a bandmaster, just keeping time. But if you want to do it like the big guys, you need to spend time rehearsing, and you need to have this rehearsal time. You can't just go in and do one rehearsal and play the concert. I mean, this was amazing for me in London when I was playing in the orchestras there. Sometimes we would have a conductor who would come in, rehearse on the day, do the concert, and the next day they'd say, what a spectacular reading of the great C major symphony this was. Well, it wasn't spectacular, it was just a regular concert, you know?
And for yourself as a conductor, and I'm asking this partly because a little later I'm certainly going to ask you about your own teaching of the flute, of course.
Yeah.
Have you found have you ever gone to take conducting lessons and find out, well, how do I do some of these things that were not as easy as I thought?
Yes, I did. I had to conduct the Aranjuez concerto, which is quite difficult technically, so I asked Lauren Mazel to help me on that. But we didn't get very far because he was busy. The overture was a simple Mozart overture. I've forgotten which one it was. It wasn't one of the big famous ones. The Schauspielhaus or something like that. I forget what it was called. But Laura knew this from memory. So he started to teach me how to do this. And just as we finished it, we're going to get on to the Aranjuez. His driver said, Maestro, we have to leave right now, otherwise you're going to be late for the rehearsal.
And I'll bet many people say that to you in the midst of interviews or lessons or other conversations. You got to go.
Yeah, they do sometimes. But, I mean, usually I'm quite good and I have it under control.
Well, I want to ask you a little bit about orchestra playing, since you did mention it, and it's something that you did quite a lot before you began your solo career, now back since 1975. Mm-hmm. And of course, many people know that that career culminated when you became principal flutist of the Berlin Philharmonic. Was that initially what you thought you would do with yourself for the rest of your professional career, is play orchestrally?
No, it wasn't. As a matter of fact, I always wanted to emulate Jean-Pierre Rampal. I thought that's the sort of career I would like to have. And at the time, when I wanted to make a recording, for example, I wanted to record with EMI. And I'll never forget the response I had from EMI. They said, well, you know, you're not French, and we can't do it. And I thought, this is ridiculous for EMI, a London-based company.
Yeah. To say to it.
Anyway, they missed out on the boat. RCA signed it up right away.
And you've been with them pretty much ever since, right?
Yes, I have, RCA. But I'm not with anybody at the moment.
Well, this is a little bit of an aside, because I wanted to ask you this maybe a little bit. I wonder what's been the effect on your career of the, not exactly the death of the major labels recording classical music, but sometimes pretty close to it. How's that affected you?
It hasn't affected my concert life. And I don't know how it affects the sale of records, but I know that after every concert, I sign records. And I sign something between 50 and 100 records, and sometimes much more, at each concert. So there is still people out there. There are still people out there looking to buy records, CDs, and of course, all of mine you can buy on Amazon, I believe.
Well, yes, at this point, yeah, Amazon and iTunes probably, and all of that.
Yeah, it just means that you can't go in a store anymore and actually listen to a record before you buy it, like you had in the old days. I mean, they cut all that sort of customer relations bit out, which was sad.
Yeah, and unfortunately, largely the major labels stopped sending anything to radio stations, too.
Yeah, you're kidding.
No.
Really?
No, yeah, quite some time ago. So
wow,
our last recordings.
That is amazing.
Yeah, our last recordings of yours have been quite a while ago.
I always had a great time going into places like Virgin in New York and coming out with about 50 recordings that I was never going to listen to.
Do you listen to your own recordings?
No. No, you know what I listened to before I came on this tour? I listened to Lohengrin, three different versions.
Oh, yeah.
The one with Rudolf Kempe, and the one with Scholte, and the one with Bitchkoff.
Now, what was, is that a, are you on a Wagner opera kick, or what was the, what made you decide to do that?
I really like listening to Wagner, you know, even if nobody sang a word, just what goes on in the orchestra is like a symphony in itself.
Do you take,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, do you take inspiration from that into your own playing, or is it purely a separate kind of listening experience?
No, that's just a listening experience. But I mean, of course, you know, when you hear these things, you become something of an expert in listening to them and what to expect. You know, for example, I have a feeling that conductors who are not instrumental players tend to play things too quick, because they don't have a feeling for the music in the same way as they would if they played a violin, for example.
So when you say instrumental players as opposed to...
Piano players.
Mm. Because piano players can play faster or something.
Well,
they just don't have the feeling.
They don't really
for that.
Get into it the same way as violin and singers do. It's a different world. It's more of a digital thing. If you see what I mean.
Yeah, digits meaning the fingers in this case.
Right.
Not
that's right.
Digital recording, yeah.
No, I mean it's a digital thing. They're all, piano playing is all about fingering and fast things and stuff and playing Franz Liszt quicker than everybody else, you know, it seems to me. And if you get someone playing the violin, they don't go racing off at ridiculous speeds.
Well, you've we're sort of hopping around here, which is great, actually, sort of giving me my next question. You've done a lot of what would be called showpieces for the flute, where, of course, flute can probably play faster than any other wind instrument beside, you know, that any other wind instrument, except maybe the clarinet.
I was going to say, clarinet players are not bad. There's some really great ones on the market these days.
They can really fly through.
Oh, yes.
But you've always, it seems to me anyway, whenever you do a showpiece that maybe has a lot of fingers and a lot of flash, you've always kept the music in it. And I wonder how, you know, what sort of lessons you've taken from.
Well, these things were inspired mostly by Jascha Heifetz, because he plays things quite virtuosic, and also the music is still there.
How
you know what I mean? When he plays the Tchaikovsky violin concerto, it's a little bit quicker than most people play it, but every note is right in the middle. And, you know, the slow movements are always great. He plays with such a passion.
Well, I want to play a piece of that you recorded, it wasn't all that long ago, on a wonderful recording that you called Music for My Little Friends.
Oh, yeah.
And this is a beautiful piece that I'd actually never heard elsewhere, and maybe I should have. It's by a fellow named Philippe Goddard, a madrigal. And since you mentioned slow movements, it's a really, really pretty tune that you play beautifully. Tell me about this piece. Was this originally for flute?
Oh, yeah, sure. Gobert was a flute player, and he was also a conductor. He conducted the National Opera in France. He was the chief conductor for several years, as was his teacher before him, Paul Taffanel. Taffanel began his career as a flute player. Then, as a result of some spectacularly bad dentistry in France, he became a conductor, but he became the chief conductor of the National Opera. That's a big opera house in the middle of Paris. He was the boss. And he did that for about 15 years, conducted everything from memory. Mm-hmm. And one of his students was Philippe Gobert, and he did exactly the same thing. And Taffanel didn't teach in the conservatoire until after his health failed and he could not conduct anymore. He became the chief teacher at the conservatoire. And I have to say, it's not bad having a teacher who was a great conductor, a great flute player, and a composer all rolled into one, listening to you playing your scales.
Oh, I'll bet. Well, let's give this piece a listen. It's by Philippe Gobert, simply called Madrigal, James Galway, flutist and conductor of the London Mozart Players. And featured here as well is pianist Philip Mall. James Galway is my guest here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Music by Philippe Gobert, simply called Madrigal. James Galway, flutist and conductor of the London Mozart Players, also featured pianist Philip Mall. James Galway is coming to the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts for a performance with his wife, Lady Jeannie Galway, and the Irish Chamber Orchestra, led by Joanne Folletta. They'll be doing, among other things, jointly, Philip Hammond's Carillon Variations, a world premiere. More with James Galway, who's my guest on Live and Local today, in just a moment. Our broadcast is made possible with support from the Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner. Going back a little bit to the notion of orchestral playing and then moving into solo playing, you mentioned that you had you wanted to emulate the career of Jean-Pierre Rampal, and even today there are flutists especially who say, oh, well, I like the playing of Rampal, or I like the playing of Galway, and it's like you have to choose sides sometimes if you're a flutist, it seems. And I wonder what else you took from him, musically speaking, that you still feel you carry with you.
From Jean-Pierre?
Yeah.
I don't think too much. What really impressed me with Jean-Pierre was the sort of panache with which he played the flute. You know, he was just technically streets above everybody else. But then who popped into my life was another French flute player called Marcel Moyse. And the lessons I had from him were just spectacular. I mean, he really showed me how to play the flute.
So your work with Jean-Pierre Rampal was not so much as teacher-student.
No, I didn't. I didn't study with Rampal. I was at the conservatoire and studied with Gaston Crunel. But I had a couple of lessons privately with Jean-Pierre. And the first time I played for him, he said, "Jimmy, you should just go get yourself a job somewhere." That's what he said.
Hence the orchestral playing, for a while.
Yeah, well, I played in the orchestra for something like about 15 years.
Yeah, a long time. Well, you know, many people would assume that the principal flute of the Berlin Philharmonic is the pinnacle of the profession. I know you wanted to be a soloist. Did you feel that you had gotten enough from orchestral playing?
No, I felt that, you know what happened? I wanted to play a concert of the Bach sonatas, and I had this little tour fixed up or to be confirmed. And it all hanged upon Herbert von Karajan giving me permission to take off a concert. So I asked him about this, and he said, "Oh, you know, on that concert, I'm playing the Schoenberg Violin Concerto and the Bartok Concerto, and I would like you to be there." So this, of course, really upset me, and I had to cancel this little tour, and especially when it came to the day. Karajan said to the orchestra, "Ladies and gentlemen," or "gentlemen," as we were in those days, he said, "I can't do the Schoenberg because I really didn't have time to learn it."
Oh, geez.
So he did the Mozart A major piano concerto with some French piano player. So you can imagine my feeling at that. So it was at that point I decided, okay, I'm out of here.
Yeah, well, solo careers have probably been launched for worse reasons than that. And, of course, here you are all these years later, and people call you a living legend of the flute. And you know, that term can probably be used often, but it certainly seems to be true these days.
Actually, you know what Jean-Pierre said to Charlie Rose?
Oh, Charlie Rose, the interviewer.
Yeah, Rose interviewed Jean-Pierre, and he said, "You know, you're the world's best flute player." And before he could go any further, Jean-Pierre said, I'm an ordinary flute player." He said, "There's many flute players who are good flute players, but there's only one, Jimmy Galway."
Well, that's what Jean-Pierre Rampal said.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, that was nice of him to say that. What did he mean exactly?
He was a very charming and very just person. You know, I think jealousy never, ever entered into his head. You know, he was never jealous of anybody or upset about any situation that would cause normal people to be jealous. He was not like that at all.
What do you think he meant by that?
Well, he meant that I was outstanding amongst all the other flute players.
As both a player and as an entertainer, perhaps?
Well, I wasn't entertaining in those days. I was just busy doing what everybody else did. But you see, gradually over my career, things changed and things became a bit more légère in the concert hall. We didn't have this sort of stiff business that we have now. People would, in my day, when people went to a concert, they all wore suits and ties and stuff. Now they go along with baseball hats to listen to the Dvorak cello concerto. You know what I mean? It's changed. So therefore, the attitude of the musicians, I think, should change with the time. I think it's time that people spoke to the audience, said something, and didn't expect the audience to come in and worship them just for playing the Mozart D major concerto and walking off again and saying goodbye. You know, you have to be there for the audience. You have to be there afterwards to sign records. A lot of people don't do that, and I think it's a real big mistake.
And it's something that I assume you do not only out of obligation, but also because you really enjoy meeting your public.
No, I really enjoy it because I get people turning up with photographs and they say, do you remember, this was us 20 years ago?
And then you say, of course I do, right?
Me with my black beard and everything.
Things do change. You know, I had a question from one of my colleagues here, a fellow named Victor Geronimo, who's on our classical music staff, who has talked to you a few times, he said. And he wanted to know if you feel that is it easier today to be a flutist than back when you got started, particularly as a soloist?
No, I don't think so. I think it depends what sort of flutist you want to be and how you go about doing it. I mean, there are different schools of flute playing which are very, very good. And I'm afraid that the American one is like about number four. And this statement is backed up by the fact that if you look at the solo flutists of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra's Young Frenchman, if you look at the Met, it's both Russian and Icelandic. And if you look at the New York Phil, it's Montreal. And they all have one thing in common. They're all French trained by way of England or by way of France. And then, of course, the Italians, they are really very good flute players.
What do you think is the difference?
Well, the difference is like this. In France, they have a method, and that's what you use. There's no shortcut, and there's no the teacher doesn't discuss with the student to make it a little bit easier for the student. They say, this is how you do it, this is what's required. If you don't do it, you're not going to make it. So we all do it. I mean, when I was in the conservatoire in France, in Paris, I was in the French class. There's two. There was a class for foreigners and class for the French, and one place was open to competition, and I won it. And the difference between these two classes was remarkable. Our class, we had two lessons a week. One was on scales and etudes. The other one was on interpretation. And we were required to learn one new piece every week, and it overlapped, you know, that we would play. We would learn a piece and play it the next week, and the next week we would get the bones of a new piece, if you see what I mean. So at the end of a term, you had several very good pieces that you could really play.
I think most, I'll just say American flutists only because, of course, I'm a product of American conservatory, essentially, myself. And I think most instrumentalists would be shocked and appalled to know that you would have one class a week on scales.
Well, we had to play for 45 minutes. I mean, we had a scale method, and we had to play all these scales. And it involved the first set of four letters that we had to follow, A, B, C, D. A was a chromatic scale, the whole tone scales, augmented and diminished arpeggios, and then the major scales, followed by the minor scales, followed by arpeggios of three notes, followed by arpeggios of four notes. That was augmented and diminished triads and things like that. And that took roughly about, I mean, if you're a good player and you practice these things, it would take you roughly about half an hour to play them. But if you really practice them, it could take longer because playing is different from practicing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did. And then we'd have to play an etude. And these etudes that we played were Anderson Opus 15, number 1, Anderson was 15, which was just one study a week we had to learn. But you see, people don't learn these studies in America simply because they don't understand why they should. You know, I always think about people training. I always think of Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, when you see him in one of his big macho poses holding a gun that weighs heavier than me, and you see all these muscles in his arm. Well, he didn't get those muscles in his arm by taking a shortcut, right?
He did what he had to do.
That's it. He did what he had to do, and he followed the instructions of some very good people who taught him how to do it.
Well, this is a wonderful lead-in to something that I know is a project extremely dear to your heart. It's called First Flute, which is an online interactive series of lessons for flute students, music lovers, that is going to be launched, I think, next month.
Yes, it is.
Tell me about that. What made you decide this was what you wanted to do next?
Well, I have a friend in New York, and we were discussing one day about how to play the flute, and he's not a flute player. And I explained to him basically what you do. And he said to me, you know, you ought to make a record of this, a film. So we got down to it, and we made 15 segments from when you get the flute out of the box till you stand up and play your first little recital, Handel Sonata or whatever. And these 15 segments cover everything that you need to do to have a really good foundation on the flute. And this is of the utmost importance. And I mean, a lot of young teachers could benefit from just looking at these things, because I explain how you go about it. And half the kids who teach the flute, they don't know how to go about it, if you see what I mean. They don't know about how to stand, how to hold the flute, how to line the flute up, how to look after it, and how to do everything that you need to do.
Well,
and this would definitely give them a lot of help in teaching their students.
And these initial 15 online lessons called Foundations, I assume this is the first installment of what you imagine will be a long series coming after this.
Yeah, the next one coming up, I tell you, I've really got to step up to the bar here and play all these difficult pieces.
Okay.
And explain to everybody what we're doing.
Oh, I doubt that there's any matter of proving yourself through this. I think everybody would be shocked if you couldn't.
Well, I tell you something interesting. In these lessons, I never did any retakes. This is how it is, warts and all, in the playing. You know, when I play the 4A Fantasy, for example, or any of these other flute pieces that go a bit quick, that was it. We got in a church one day and recorded the whole thing right through, nonstop. So you can see the result of my sticking to a method.
Is that you can play these things on short notice.
Yeah, but you know what the interesting thing about the Paris Conservatoire was? My teacher, old Gaston Crunel, he was great. I mean, he was a very good flute player, really good. He read the newspaper and smoked gitane all the way through the scales and arpeggios.
While he was playing them or while you were playing them?
No, we were playing them. But if you made one mistake, he was right on to you. But, of course, none of us made mistakes because we were busy trying to elbow the other one out. The classes started at 8 o'clock in the morning, and by the time 12 o'clock rolled on, everything had got progressively faster.
I imagine so. That's what competition competition can do for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to play a recording next, and I'll tell you why I'm playing this particular one after we're done. There's two reasons for it, really. This is one of your many, many, many collaborative recordings. This one happens to be called A Song of Home, An American Musical Journey, which you made with fiddler Jay Unger and guitarist and pianist Molly Mason, and I think she did some singing on here. And this is a tune called My Cape Breton Home. And you're actually playing the tin whistle here. It's James Galway, ladies and gentlemen, here on Live and Local. He's coming to the Krannert Center for a concert that has absolutely nothing to do with the tin whistle, I don't think, on Thursday night. And he's my guest here on Live and Local. We'll be right back. That's music called My Cape Breton Home with James Galway on the whistle. Jay Unger played fiddle and Molly Mason on guitar. And James Galway coming for a concert with his wife, Lady Jeannie Galway. More on her in just a moment with the Irish Chamber Orchestra Thursday night at the Krannert Center in Urbana. And the reason I played that particular recording was twofold, but the initial one having to do with teaching, as I understand it, now anyway, and maybe it was true in your day, many Irish students, when they're learning to play music, start on the whistle.
I don't know about that, because I played the whistle after I learned the flute.
Is that right? That was yeah. That's partly what
but
I wondered about.
I don't think they do that, actually, but I can't be sure because I can't speak for that.
Well, tell me a little bit about how you came to decide to play the whistle, and did therefore traditional Irish music come to you after classical music?
To answer the question back to front, the Irish music came after, but the reason I got into it was I was playing all the six Bach sonatas in the Queen Elizabeth Hall with Colin Tilney and another friend of mine, Adam Skeeping, and we were playing as near as we could get it to the original. You know, Adam was playing the gamba instead of the cello, and Colin played the harpsichord. And I thought it was pretty good, but the audience absolutely ate it up, and it was a packed house, and they kept clapping and clapping, and we went and played another movement of one sonata that we'd already played before. And then Colin said, okay, that's it, I'll go home. They were still clapping. I said, okay, you go home. I'll play my tune on the tin whistle. So I got out the tin whistle and played a couple of jigs. And that was the beginning of me playing the tin whistle.
Is that something you've found at all challenging, or does that come easy once you've learned the flute?
No, it comes easy once you've learned the flute, because it's basically the same principle in fingering. But of course, there's added to that a certain style, and this style I don't have. I play the tin whistle like a flute player, and all the ornaments that I do are based on my previous playing of Rameau and French compositions like Blavet, Leclerc, and these sort of composers, and it seems to work quite well. But I would really love to take a year off and study the tin whistle so I can play it like a real Irishman.
Well, you've played a lot. Well, you played with the group that I just heard played, which of course is not Irish group, but traditional American, really. And then,
right.
But you played a lot with the Chieftains, especially. Have they not given you any pointers?
Oh, they did. But I mean, it was when I first played with the Chieftains, it wasn't a question of pointers. I was doing my thing. They were doing their thing, and we were getting it ready to record real quick. So there was no question of them showing me how to play Irish music. We just did what we could.
Well, I wondered
and then,
if...
then gradually, as it went along the concerts, I would pick up something to do different. And the guys would all laugh at me and say, Jerry, you're beginning to sound like one of us, meaning Catholic.
Yeah, you didn't... That didn't cause any wars, I hope.
No.
Another question from my colleague Vic DiGeronimo here. He wanted to know if you're still able to play two tin whistles at once, one out of each side of your mouth.
Yes, I am. I am, and I haven't done that for ages. And maybe I ought to do that one of these days.
Well, there's your encore when you come to Urbana on Thursday.
Yeah, but I've only got one tin whistle with me.
Ah, Well, you know, there's a lot of Irish music going on here in Champaign-Urbana. I'm sure you could borrow one.
I'm sure.
Anybody out there who's hearing it, just bring your whistle along and bring it up at the intermission, and maybe he'd do it. Well, we can find out, I suppose. But the other reason I played that particular recording was just to introduce the topic very briefly of the many, many different types of collaborations that you have done over the years with non-classical groups. You've played with rock bands. You've played with, of course, traditional, as we've talked about. What's in it for you to do that instead of just playing exclusively classically?
Well, let me ask you this. If you got a call from Roger Waters to play with Pink Floyd, what would you do? You would say, no, get the second flute in the orchestra to do that. He does that.
I'd probably panic is what I would do. I'd panic.
Yeah, not half. I mean, I just jumped it right in there. I mean, you know, apart from thinking that the Pink Floyd are one of the great bands of all time, being asked to play with them, you really can't turn that down. So, but you see, the crossover business began way, way back, and everybody was at it. You know, Fritz Kreisler, Rachmaninoff, they were all good crossover guys. And Gili, for example, they all sang crossover tunes. Even in the opera house, Caruso sang, when Sir Harry Lauder came to listen to an opera, I think Gili sang that popular Scottish song, "You Take the High Road and I'll Take the..." He sang that as an encore. You see, so this crossover feeling was always there. And then, like I explained earlier on, each generation shifts a little bit in what they expect. And each generation gets a bit more free in what they expect. So you can do almost anything these days, if you see what I mean. But in those days when I first started, I made the first crossover record, I think was called The Man with the Golden Flute. And it contained a lot of pieces that Heifetz had recorded with piano, but I decided it would be better to step it up and record it with orchestra, because the kids of that generation were used to hearing things with orchestra. So playing flute and piano would be a regression, if you understand what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So then the next records that you made had to have something different. So that's why we ended up with things like The Wind Beneath My Wings, with synthesizers and everything like that in it, and guitars. So each record had to be a step forward. But at the very beginning, we had to be a little bit more suit and tie. Then we got rid of the tie. Then we got rid of the suit. But I have to keep my shirt on. I don't want the girls getting excited.
Do you ever include some of the crossover music, for lack of a better term, in your classical concerts?
No, not really. Unless it's a sort of concert where we're asked to do like a Mozart concerto and do a pop second half.
Mm-hmm.
Then I play some pieces by Henry Mancini or these sort of things, or some of the little showcase things that I used to do.
What's the most unusual collaboration you ever had?
Do you know, I really don't never thought about that.
Well, I'll give you an example. I was poking around on YouTube yesterday, and I found one of Jean-Pierre Rampal performing with Miss Piggy.
Oh, yeah, I've done that. I played with Meryl Sheep. And the puppeteer who did Meryl Sheep used to be my wife's roommate. They shared a room. And when I say they shared a room, it was a room and two beds in it.
All right. Well, we'll take that as you've played with the Muppets too, and that's pretty unusual. But since you've mentioned your wife, that is a lead-in for Thursday's concert, which we've really talked hardly at all about. James Galway, my guest here on Live and Local, he'll be with the Irish Chamber Orchestra Thursday night at 7:30. Joanne Follett is conducting the concert. She'll be my guest, by the way, on Thursday's program. And Lady Jeanie Galway will also be featured in one of the pieces. The program includes Hamilton Hardy's In Ireland, which is for flute and orchestra, and then Mozart's D major flute concerto, which will, of course, feature Sir James. The program will end with Mendelssohn's Scottish Symphony. I hope that's okay in an Irish program.
Yeah, that's fine. Good old Celts.
Yeah. And then this piece by Philip Hammond called Carillon Variations. It's a premiere of some sort of a version for two flutes and orchestra. Tell me about this piece and how it has always been to collaborate with your wife. It's got to be wonderful.
Well, I can only say that I really enjoy playing on the stage with my wife, Jeanie. You know, we've done it so often, and we've got it really to a good point. You know, normally I would have to fly in, practice with the first flute of the orchestra for an hour, and then do it. Whereas Jeanie and I, we've been doing it for years, and we've got it together. What was the other question you asked me there?
The piece, Carillon Variations. Tell me about that a little bit.
Oh, Carillon Variations. Yeah, well, Phil Hammond is a young, well, not young anymore, Belfast composer. He's about my age, probably 65. And Jeanie asked him one day to write a flute concerto, and he didn't say yes or no. But the next time we met him, he gave us the manuscript of these two variations on the music of O Carillon. And, of course, you know, Carillon was this famous blind harpist who wrote tons and tons of music that made the backbone of all traditional music.
And he was what, in the 1600s, something like that?
Maybe 17. Maybe even 18, I'm not sure. I'll have to Wikipedia him. So he gave us this piece, and we played it for two flutes and piano, and then we thought it'd be a good idea to get it orchestrated, so we asked Philip to do it, so he arranged it for orchestra, and it's a beautiful arrangement, I have to say, and the orchestra plays it great.
Well, I'm sure they do, and folks will be able to hear it live, of course. The best way to hear anybody, in particular Sir James Galway and Lady Jeanie Galway, they'll be playing the Carillon Variations of Philip Hammond, and then the rest of the program as I described it. It's 7:30 on Thursday night at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. You can get more information at krannertcenter.com. I wanted to go out with a performance by James and Jeanie Galway and the London Mozart Players, with Sir James conducting. This is the final movement of the Concerto for Two Flutes by Domenico Cimarosa. Sir James Galway, I really appreciate your taking all the time to talk with me today, and I'm looking forward to hearing you on Thursday night.
My pleasure, and thank you for taking time as well.
Sir James Galway and Lady Jeanie Galway in the final movement of the Concerto for Two Flutes and Chamber Orchestra by Domenico Cimarosa. James Galway conducting the London Mozart Players in that performance here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. They will appear in a concerto, well, not a concerto, rather, the Carillon Variations by Philip Hammond on a program that is really quite varied with the Irish Chamber Orchestra Thursday night at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana. This is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. Our programs are made possible with the support of the Friends of WILL and in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, an agency of the state of Illinois. You're listening to 90.9 WILL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music and More for Central Illinois. WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. It's 5 o'clock.